Okay, good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin again this evening, recognizing those who came before us, the practitioners, the noble ones, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, taking refuge, Buddha, the awakening, the awakened one, awakening within ourselves, the Dharma, the truth of the way things are, the Sangha, so we can have this rather intimate idea of Sangha, which is right here, which is very powerful, very potent, and right here, and this long history of Sangha that comes from the time of the Buddha on, before previous Buddhas. So there's practitioners on throughout the ages. If you feel like chanting along, you can. No requirement on this. And if you don't like it, you can just kind of tune it out. But I kind of like it, so. Buddham saranam gacchami, dharmam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami, buddham saranam gacchami, dharmam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami, buddham saranam gacchami, dharmam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami. So tonight I wanted to bring our attention together and focus on gratitude for this incredible life and some thoughts that we have to support our practice. I got a title here with just kind of things, the way that they kind of started developing for this, putting together notes for talking with you tonight. You know, and some of the major themes were merit, wisdom, and the preciousness of this life. This morning while we were practicing, very spontaneously, gratitude for this collected space, for the very soft clarity and silence, stillness, and the incredible work that you've all done, the incredibly deep work that you've all been doing. So this just kind of welled up, and I just felt it, just this gratitude of just being here, being in your presence, being in the presence of this space. This was very palpable, very, very strong. Gratitude in that way, it's kind of its own reward. It's just so fulfilling, just noticing that. So we can kind of come at gratitude in a couple of different directions. One, we can kind of muster it. We can kind of think about it and muster it. And it can spontaneously be there. Either way is good. This is good. Gratitude is good. Recognizing. So I think this coming to life with the reverence and with this acknowledgement of all of this that is coming into our lives, it's really important. And it gives rise to the, what I feel is the paramitas, the perfections. So gratitude isn't specifically mentioned, might be somewhere in some text somewhere, but gratitude in my view, this reverence and gratitude kind of naturally opens one up to this whole stream of the paramitas. And I'm going to go through the paramitas from the Mahayana tradition. There's the six paramitas, slightly different than Theravada, but the spirit is all here. Okay? Theravada, Mahayana. All really going towards the same essence here. So the first one is generosity. And kind of we look at generosity, it's this open-hearted giving. So when we have this gratitude, it's just natural, this open-heartedness. So generosity just comes from this open-hearted space. And we're going to see this kind of common theme through all the paramitas as this open-hearted space, which is not different from open spaciousness that we're recognizing here, that's holding all of our sensations, holding our thoughts, feelings. So generosity. The next one is discipline, refraining from harming and caring for oneself and others. So this also has this deep open-heartedness in it of caring for others. So it's not just this vow that, oh, I'm not going to do this because I'm not supposed to. This is coming, ideally this is where it's coming from. When we connect with that, then it has real meaning. We can do it outwardly with an outward enforced rule, or we can do it inwardly from a deep caring for life. And so this kind of discipline, really this caring, so then it blends into some of the other paramitas here. So this discipline can be thought of as this deep caring for others and oneself, and putting these guidelines for ourselves just to kind of help us navigate life. And it kind of blends into the next paramita, patience. Be non-judgmental of oneself, of others. Of course, you know, we can have enforced patience from the outside. I'm going to be patient here. I'm going to be patient. Or it can come from a different place, and you can see the difference. You can feel the difference. And this comes from practice. So we're tapping into this. So we haven't really acknowledged or recognized that. That's why I thought it'd be good to bring it out. It's there. And it is more potent when we come to just acknowledge and recognize that. So we recognize this development of generosity, of discipline, of patience. All of these really are coming from this practice right here. And that's when they have real potency. That's where they're coming with the real potency. And diligence. Finding joy in what is positive and wholesome. And diligence also has this element of energy and vigor. And this we're putting into our practice too. So that's something we bring into our practice. Again, the open-heartedness fuels the diligence. Some of these have kind of a, kind of a pejorative, I don't know what to say about some of the words, but they're a little stiff, a little hard, like we're talking about. Concentration has this kind of already built into it, this kind of judgmental, hard, efforting kind of a thing. But it doesn't have to be that way. The collected space that we feel and the collection of our mindfulness has another feel than using some of these words. But I use the words anyway, just so you know. And then meditative absorption, not being distracted. And so that also is coming into our practice as we practice. And we can see, you know, as we're practicing, sometimes distraction comes up. And so this is part of that collection and that collectiveness really provides that basis for seeing deeply. And the sixth is wisdom. And wisdom is recognizing awareness, open spaciousness. And that's what we've been practicing all this time. Recognizing awareness. I'm going to repeat this a couple times about this, the word bodhicitta. Bodhi is awakening, citta is heart-mind. So bodhicitta is the awakened heart-mind. Something I find interesting is how these all fold into one another, how they all kind of go together like, you know, Russian dolls, but every which way, you know. So the generosity is found in the discipline and the patience, and the meditative diligence is found in the meditative concentration, and wisdom is found in all of them. So this kind of circle, we just recognize. And so practice is really at the heart of all this. So kind of getting back to this whole thing of bodhicitta and like where we're going, not going anywhere, but it is important to recognize the effects and kind of acknowledge what's happening. So all of these are a channel of life flow, we could say. And that's the way I'm looking at this bodhicitta, or this awakening, of all of these kind of characteristics that we call the six paramitas. Also the four immeasurables, immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, equanimity. These are all part of life flow. As we recognize awareness and rest in awareness, we recognize these parts of life flow rather spontaneously. Kind of like that happened to me this morning, and possibly this happened to you throughout the week sometimes, of different aspects, different facets of this. First one I tap into really there is, I usually tap into the gratitude first. So again, we could say that this open-heartedness is a manifestation of gratitude, generosity, and all of the rest of the paramitas. This open-heartedness, not different from open awareness. We also, this is where it all comes into merit and wisdom as well. We're all here because, quite literally, here in this building because of merit and wisdom. And sometimes the merit, you know, it has this connotation of kind of collecting things, like collecting coins in a piggy bank. I like to look at it in a little bit different way. I like to look at it from the perspective of open awareness. That it's opening to this open channel of life. This is what's happening. And so as we open to this merit and wisdom, this is the life channel, this life-giving channel of all of these paramitas, all of these perfections are just manifesting through what we call merit and wisdom. It's just this life flow channel. So it's not so much that merit is a thing. We look at most things anyway as they're appearing and disappearing. And merit does seem to appear and disappear. But open, spacious awareness is always there. So it is always open to tap into. So bodhicitta also has the meaning of compassion. And ultimate compassion is really the recognition of emptiness, open spaciousness, awareness, non-duality. That full compassion of realizing you are quite literally not different from me. And I interbe. So there's a story. The other night we had the talk about the Heart Sutra, and the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara kind of gave the teachings in that one. So I thought I would give a little bit of a story about Avalokiteshvara. Because it's interesting, I like it, but anyway. But I just thought it would come in here because he is known as the Bodhisattva of compassion. It is said that he looked out and saw the suffering of so many beings in various realms that, the lower realms of extreme suffering. And so he couldn't stand to see all of this suffering. So he went to teach and to be with and to awaken all these beings. And so he did. He just very effectively and efficiently and skillful means and all this stuff went to all these lower, very suffering realms and awakened and brought all these beings out into awakening. And then when he looked back, he saw all the realms being filled up again. So he wept. Tears fell down his eyes. And as the pools of tears formed, out of the pools grew lotuses, and out of the lotuses grew Tara, the mother of all the Buddhas. So the female Buddha of compassion. So I like that that story is in there of, you know, a little bit more of gender equality. There's so much about gender throughout the ages of this patriarchal society and, you know, imbued in all of our religions and everything. So it's good to see at least some recognition of the feminine quality and, you know, what better form. And Tara, if you read more about Tara, just so beautiful of her open-hearted, loving compassion. And she vowed, by the way, that she would only take birth as a woman to attain Buddhahood. Because she was practicing as a human being somewhere in a female body, and some teacher said, oh, well, next birth, you can be a man and become a Buddha. And she said, no way. I'm staying as a female and I'm going to attain Buddhahood. So anyway, a little bit of backstory on Tara. A little bit more of one of my teachers, Chum Kusho. I think I told the whole thing about needlessness. I told a little bit more in a small group, I think. But she was definitely an incarnation of compassion and fierce wisdom, very fierce, but very compassionate, very beautiful human being, very fiery sometimes. I think I described her stature. She was about, yeah, I think 4'10", maybe. Maybe 4'11", I don't know. But she was of short stature and very stocky, but a force to be reckoned with. And she had absolutely no fear whatsoever. There are so many places that we took her, we went. There were places when we were in Nepal where this was the time when they had a lot of Maoists and they had military all over the place. Every kind of intersection, there was military there with guns and this and that. And they would stop you and be real kind of authoritarian with you and really kind of checking you out and getting in your face. She rolls down the window and looks at him. Says, say Tom Tara to his face. And the guy, Tom Tara. So she had this habit of making this connection with people and having them say the seed mantra of Tara, of Tom, which T-A-M was the seed syllable, mm-hmm. and Tara is the name of Tara, of course. So everywhere she'd get, whenever she would see anyone, doesn't matter whether they're, you know, holding an AK-47 or whatever, it's like she doesn't care. So it was interesting to see her fearlessness there. But everywhere, I mean, she was not afraid of being embarrassed or anything. I mean, it was inspiring to watch. So back to merit and wisdom. So merit might be thought of as this open-heartedness that unfolds as generosity and the rest unfold. And the wisdom aspect is the recognition aspect. They're not really different, but you can kind of say that. And as I mentioned before, I think there's this whole thing of accumulating merit and wisdom. It's opening to life. So this opening to life is what all of, we've done this. We've done the practice in our life. We've done whatever had it, the motivation, whatever that brought us to this place. And this place had the generosity to, from the very beginning, I think, but we'll talk more about this, but the beginning of this Franciscan Center was donated by, I can't remember the exact story, but I think he was...
Attorney.
And he asked, he was, when he passed away, he wanted to support the work of anyone doing this kind of meditative work in themselves, regardless of what sect or what religion or what they were involved in. But all of that generosity, all this merit and wisdom came to play for us to be here. Okay, and this opening actually brings us to this human life. All of this, you know, all of the support has just brought us to this human life. All of these different things kind of came together. And this human form with these arms and legs and heads and bodies and what have you. And a lot of the teachings are really about the respect and the honoring of life. Not only this human life that we have, really cherishing that in a way of really making good use of this human life, but also of all other beings. My first teacher, Sujata, is an American that traveled to Sri Lanka, became a monk. I don't know if I told this in any other my talks, but he did some intensive practice in Sri Lanka. And one story that he told was regarding the preciousness of life and respecting and valuing the life of other beings. So this is some of the first teachings he got as he took ordination as a monk and what have you. And so one day he was sweeping out his hut, and there were some ants in there, and he swept some out, and one of them accidentally got injured, maybe cut in half. And he goes, you know, I kind of blew it, but it looks like the guy's half dead, and just kind of swept him out. So afterwards, he felt some guilt, you know, and it kind of ate at him for a while. So he went back to his teacher, and he told him what happened. His teacher reminded him of intention, and that it was good that he had the intention not to kill. But he should take care to follow through with intention. I don't know what that means after he had done this, but probably still some, you know, he recognized that he was a bit careless after the fact. I mean, it does happen. Accidents happen. So it's not only not to kill, but it's this deep recognition and care for others. Coming back to the kind of the spirit that I was talking about before, this open-hearted caring. We live as we live, you know, we're going to do things. And there's also the story about the, some of the others, if you probably know the story of the monk that was walking. He's a blind monk and he was walking, and as he was walking, he was stepping in. Crushing ants. And some other monk came and told on him, said, "Hey, he's walking and crushing the ants and stuff." And the Buddha was reminding the other monks of this. It's the intention. It's the intention here. He had no intention. You know, we do things all the time. We're driving our car and squish bugs, and it's intention. It's that open-hearted bodhicitta nature that we connect with. Another little story about ants. Well, before I get, I mean, I got something going on with ants here. And there's a little history. There's a little history with this. So, and this guy here, he's always talking about ants when we're doing the walking meditation. He's talking about walking as slow as an ant. Do you ever really look at ants when they're walking? Man, they're hauling ass. I mean, they're just going all over. They've got several little legs, and they're all going fast. So, anyway, so I think, you know, covering the amount of distance might take them a little while, but yeah. Anyway, so that analogy just didn't quite work for me. Or that. I bet Paul will still do it. I mean, it's okay. So going back even a little bit further here with my history with ants. I mean, I got to cover it. Got to get it out there. Got some karma going on here, you know. Got to give the ants their due. So about 21 years ago, Joanne and I, we went to a long retreat. We went to a retreat in Myanmar, Burma, and with Sayadaw Upandita, very wonderful, you know, wonderful teacher who's now passed away. So we went to this retreat. I was very inspired. I had to go. I mean, the Dharma was calling. The calling was strong. I was practicing with Paul here. We had been doing some retreats and stuff. And anyway, I said, I had to go. It was just time to go. I had to go. I went. So it was a good retreat. At any rate, I can't remember at what point it was in the retreat. The retreat was going on there for a little bit. The meditation hall, it was kind of a two-level meditation hall. And the second level was, I think they separated the men and the women. I think the women were on the first floor and the men were on the second floor. And then we all came together at Dharma talk time when Sayadaw would be up front there and giving us a Dharma talk. And we had all, you know, we'd all be very disciplined lining up there in front. And I was always right up in the front. Side note, I had taken ordination at the time, and it was, I was the sloppiest monk going. I mean, I was a sight to behold, and not necessarily a very good one. And Joanne actually has some pictures. She brought some pictures, one of the retreats. I don't know, she brought some. And, yeah, they're fairly embarrassing. I'll just say that. But it was good. I mean, it was a very meaningful time in my life. And even though that was kind of hard, kind of managing with robes and all this and being sitting in front of Sayadaw. So he had the monk sitting up front. Even us American ones, which we didn't know what we were doing monk-wise. I mean, we were there, but, you know, we were doing the best we could. And he acknowledged that. He was really, really good with us. I mean, we got good teachings. I mean, excellent teachings. That's the understatement of the world. So anyway, I was sitting there. You know, I was probably no further from Sayadaw than like I was here from Paul here. Okay, so I was sitting there, and he was up on kind of this little bit elevated platform there. And here we were in the second floor. Didn't think anything about, you know, bugs coming in, but this was Myanmar, and all the windows and, you know, side doors were open to a little veranda that went around. And some ants had made their way up on this veranda, and there was an opening kind of out in the back corner there. And they made a line right, they didn't deviate anywhere else. They went right straight for my pad, right straight for my leg. And these little, they were little tiny flesh-eating rascals. And they came in and gnawed on my leg the entire talk. And I was, you know, probably tears were squirting out. I was, you know, I was there with Sayadaw kind of squirming and, oh. So the next days, I mean, they came in. They, after they got me, they went to a few others too, and so we had a plan. And we got Vaseline. There was a put up Vaseline circle because we had to meditate then. And I mean, that, it was pretty intense. So we had the Vaseline. We put the Vaseline around us, and then the ants still came. They came, and you know, we're kind of smiling there and doing our meditation. We got you. And they sacrificed their little bodies into the Vaseline to make a bridge. Anyway, at a certain point, we kind of had some kind of agreement with the ants. I don't know how it finally resolved. We did the Vaseline for a while, and with care and attention, it was really hard to hold the kind of bodhicitta, open-heartedness with these little bastards, excuse me. But we did. Myself and the other practitioners there were able to, you know, get on our way. And the ants, they found something else out in the forest or whatever to chew on, which I was delighted about, and we could get on with our practice. But that was part of the practice too, and it gave me a good story I could tell you now. So in the Buddhist teachings, there are considerable emphasis on this precious human life. And the reason, I think I've mentioned it in other talks, is that this human life has the potential for recognizing awareness, recognizing open spaciousness, recognizing one's own nature. We don't know about this about other incarnations, whether it's whales and dolphins or ants or birds or what have you. Maybe. We don't know. But it is important to remember with this human, precious human life, that we can recognize our own nature, when we can come together like this, and we can open to life in a very deep, profound way. And we interbe. We don't exist separately from the ants, the birds, the planet, the air, the water. I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go on, if I have time. And by the way, the other night, I think it was just luck that I hit 1 hour. I don't know what I'll do tonight. I don't think there's any way I'm going to make it tonight, Paul. I got a story, a little story on Milarepa. How many of you know the story of Milarepa? So if you all said yes, then I would go ahead, I would skip this. No, I wouldn't. I got to tell the story. If you know the story of Milarepa, you know you want to hear it again, with the caveat that I will probably get details wrong and details differently than the way you've read the story or heard the story. But I want to get to this one kind of salient point that was in the end there that I just really like. So a little bit of the backstory of Milarepa for those of you. So there were some that haven't heard the story right, so at least you will think I got the story right. So Milarepa, this is... The year was, in the Middle Ages sometimes, around 10-something A.D. Mila, his sister, his mother, and his father lived in Tibet. And his father got gravely ill, passed away. And the patriarchal system there was that everything went to the male in the lineage there, which was Milarepa's father's brother, so his uncle. And his uncle was not a very nice guy, oppressed him, and his aunt and uncle just turned them into slaves, this and that. Long story short, this could be a real, real long story. This could take several talks probably. But anyway, so his mother kind of encouraged Milarepa to go off and learn some black magic to kind of take the revenge. And he did, he felt great remorse after this, and he was feeling kind of the pangs and the fears of karma and really feeling that weight, the guilt of, I'm not going to go into all the details, but if you like the story, you should go read them. If you haven't read it, go find The Life of Milarepa. So after that, after he had done these acts of taking revenge, he actually did some black magic to create hailstorms and ruin crops and ruin houses and take out a wedding and a whole bunch of people. And he did some serious wrath on them, and wasn't a great situation there for those people. And right after that, Mila had this deep reckoning within himself and says, I've got to find the Dharma. This is not right. This was wrong. And I've got to find out what this life is about. And he went to find his teacher, Marpa. We did find, and I forgot to make this very long story a lot shorter. But he went through a lot of trials with Marpa. Marpa had him do lots of things and not really getting the teachings. He had him building these towers and houses, and every time he told him he wanted one here, the next day he'd come back and say, no, I told you that, I was drunk. Don't tear it down, put it over here, and so forth. Really a lot of trials, and he wasn't getting the teachings. And Marpa was really renowned for having all these teachings. He had gone to India, received the teachings, brought them back to Tibet, and so forth and so on. So, anyway, finally, after all these trials and tribulations, there are several breaking points, and finally Marpa gave him the teachings. He ended up going off into the caves and doing incredibly intensive practice. Having hardly anything to eat, he was just drinking nettle tea. So just some bushes that were around, which were nettles, probably had some nutrient in it, but from what I understand, he turned like green from, that's all he had in the system. So he turned green. He almost looked like some kind of a ghost or demon or something. But anyway, he achieved great realization. One of the great, great Tibetan yogis practiced the practice of Tummo. So Tummo is the practice of heat. It's kind of related to Kundalini and the yogic system, and in this system in the Tibetan or the Vajrayana system of generating heat in the body. It's kind of using the energies and channeling the energies in a particular way to actually generate heat. And actually one of the tests they do after practitioners have practiced this for a while, they would get sheets, soak them in water, and wrap them in the, they would sit in the snow and dry them off. Once they can dry so many, then they're secure in the Tummo practice. Anyway, here he was high in the mountains, really high in the mountains, practicing Tummo. Just all he had was a cotton shawl, not even a wool one, cotton shawl. That's all he had. No undies, nothing. There's whole stories about all that too. We won't go into it. A lot of details that I'm missing that are just really incredible. There are really some really good stories. But getting back to the point that I wanted to make after all of that, so he's done all of this practice, and he had some many, many renowned disciples, and one of them was Gampopa. And after he had practiced with them for years, many years, and Gampopa was getting ready to leave, and so I can't remember what Mila volunteered this or whether Gompopa asked him for his parting teaching. And so Milarepa did give him his parting teaching. And so as Gompopa was walking away, he threw up his robes and mooned him. And so what was that about? That was that he showed him his leathery, calloused behind. And telling him, this is what you do, you practice. So it was showing him that he, this is what he had done. And this was his parting. Practice. Practice with diligence, and that's what he's done in his life. Okay, so. So since we're talking a little bit Tibetan tradition here, so this was Milarepa's reminder to Gompopa and to all of us to just re-engage into life and to look deeply with care. The Tibetan tradition, they have that a teaching called the Four Thoughts That Turn the Mind. It's kind of related to the Bardos in a way. The Bardos, Paul's mentioned it, I think I might have mentioned it here or there. The Bardos are in between transitional states. States between thoughts. Everything is a Bardo. This whole life is change. So Bardo is really about change. So everything is change. But these are particular, kind of looking at it in kind of a some particular important gaps, gaps between thoughts, gaps between breaths. So those are some important ones that we can use in practice. But there's also the gap between waking and sleep, dreaming. So we can go into sleep, go into dreaming. So those are some important gaps. So those are potentials for real seeing, real insight. So the Bardos that we're familiar with, the Bardo of this life, all of the change, all the little Bardos within this life, the little transitions that we can take heed of and note. And then there's the transition into sleep and dreaming, and then there's the transition into meditative awareness, meditative absorption. Which we've kind of experienced some of that, perhaps, in our retreat so far. So the first thought that turns the mind is the Bardo of this life. But not just the Bardo, but recognizing that this life is the precious human life that offers the potential for realization. So the second thought that comes right behind that, you can really spend a lot of time. I actually spend some time every day. Just you can spend some time with these thoughts that turn the mind, and you can actually do some contemplation on that before you do your practice. Second thought is that of recognizing that all of these aggregates die. These are impermanent. Everything is impermanent. All of our situation is impermanent. Our situation is going to change. This body is going to change. This body is going to actually die. I mean, we all know that, but it is important to really kind of clearly see that. So in the book, Mingyur Rinpoche's book, I think I talked about, might have talked about it in small groups and talked about it here and there. I believe the title is In Love with Life, A Monk's Journey through the bardos of living and dying. And so he tells about his near-death experience. It says, when all these cycles, so I'm going to read a little bit from Nyingma Rinpoche's book, because it's so valuable. I do encourage you to go out and get it. I really do. It's just a really, really profound book. When all these cycles of the body and mind stop functioning, all that's left is awareness itself, the unconditioned open space of pure knowing. But this knowing now has no object whatsoever. This is why the moment of death is so special, for it provides the most precious opportunity. And here he gives a very nice teaching here. When the cup breaks, the contained space joins the space that has no edges, that is not contained. What came into focus very clearly was that while the experience of luminosity presents itself, most of us will miss it. That's why we train, not for the experience, which is a gift of nature. And when he's speaking about not for the experience, which is a gift of nature, it's that experience, the actual death, that bardo of death, that transition from this life, which is, as he puts it, a gift of nature, but to recognize it. Training to recognize the nature of our minds familiarize us with the child luminosity. That's what he was describing in the cup. There's a child luminosity. And this familiarity is what allows us to approach the end of our bodies without fear and dread. If you'll indulge me for a couple more minutes. So he's got a little chapter here I'm going to read a little bit from. It's called When the Cup Shatters. So this is, he's had some experience of food poisoning, of dysentery, dehydration, of everything that has worn him completely out. And he was in the process of deciding whether he should go. He was in the park of Kushinagar, which is the place where they have where the Buddha passed. And they have a stupa there. And he was leaning up against this stupa, holding the Buddha, who ironically did die of food poisoning, essentially. So anyway, he went through a lot of internal turmoil of whether he should go and see if he could contact someone, get them to call one of the monasteries and come get him and get him some help. So he could have done that. He could have done it. They were just around. I mean, people were in this park, but here he was, just a monk. They just saw a monk sitting by the stupa. But he went through this process and let it go. And he says, the effects of this profound acceptance of just letting it go came quickly. Within 10 or 15 minutes, the agitation I experienced began to decompress. Tensions drained out. From top to bottom, my forehead, jaws, neck, my shoulders, hands, everything dropped down. The deep sigh that signals the completion of a tremendous effort circulated throughout my arteries. Ah, my mood shifted. I sat with open eyes, enjoying a type of weather that follows hurricane rains when the sun reappears and the birds sing again and the air feels refreshed. Perhaps I would not die after all. Assessing that the crisis might have passed soon proved inaccurate. Making the decision to remain in Kushinagar settled my mind but not my stomach. I continued to squat in the bushes, and by now, every movement confirmed that my body was slipping further toward irreversible cessation. This brought with it renewed determination to work with the instructions for the Bardo of Dying. This is a practitioner. The day before, a genuine concern had given rise to these same contemplations, but I had not yet abandoned a whisper that told me everything will be okay. Now, those assurances were nowhere to be found. I continued to lean against the outside wall of the cremation stupa, but my mind felt stronger than it had for the past few days. And I initiated the offering practice, so a particular practice that I was going through right before death of offering. I did not nod off or lose track or think about it, but approached each one with a resolve and devotion I had not tapped into the day before. I was not preparing to die. I was not in the monastery of my childhood, laying on the floor and listening to guided meditations on dying. I was no longer concerned with the concepts of living or dying. For what else could they be but insubstantial concepts? But with giving everything I had to whatever was happening right now to meet the demands of this moment without attachment or aversion and to befriend any adversity, living, dying, two concepts equally distant from this moment. This is who and where I am right now. This being just doing this activity. And this body making these aspirations, nothing more, nothing less, just trying to fully inhabit the infinite universe of each moment. I'm going to leave it there for you to go back and carry on and read more of Mingyur's story of his experience, which I said is like this, it continues in its profundity. So I didn't make it, Paul. I passed the 8 o'clock mark.
Keep going.
The third thought, and this kind of weaves in where if you can just feel that just immediacy of experiencing one's own passing and him chronicling that. So the third thought is that of the currents of karma are infallible. So in the bardo of passing from this life, there is the luminosity of Dharmakaya. As he was saying, that most of us will miss it if we practice in seeing open, spacious awareness. That potential is much, much greater that we see this. And then that's it. But what follows from, I mean, everybody gets that. They get it. Free of charge. Everybody gets it. You got a body. You're going through this experience. You're going to go through the luminosity of Dharmakaya. So you might faint. You might just go, wow, or whatever. I don't know. Who knows? Because we don't have any recordings from the beyond to actually record what's going on. We have reports like Mingyur Rinpoche and others that have had near-death experiences, which are incredible. But beyond that, after the experience of the luminosity of Dharmakaya, comes the bardo, or the in-between after that, is the bardo of what they call the bardo of Dharmata, of appearances, a kind of a dream-like, kind of trying to find your way, not having a body anymore. What's this? Kind of like a dream-like state. And various forms and images can appear. Some could be frightful. Some can be beautiful, depending on your karma. But all of them are what is referred to. If one is awake and sees them, they can be revealed as what is called the Sambhogakaya. Sambhogakaya is the Buddha in kind of non-form, but not of the not like just totally unmanifest open spaciousness, but of appearing but empty, but appearing. So appearances, so there can be like Chenri Zig or Avalokiteshvara of Tara. All these Buddhas, these bodhisattvas, great beings, can be seen as, you know, some would call spirits. But I don't think that's a very good way to say it. But otherwise, you know, when in our constricted mind, we can see them as either fierce or frightening or like, what's that? That is the bardo of the Dharmata. And the fourth thought is the unsatisfactoriness of samsara. And that goes along with the bardo of becoming, of trying to find a place to land, coming back into form, craving form. And there is the cycle of samsara, which is the cycle of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences. If we want to kind of bring it back to kind of our direct experience, that is the cycle of samsara, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences, and wanting the pleasant, not wanting the unpleasant, and trying desperately to make that work permanently. It never works permanently. We can get it to work a little bit, some of the time. Kind of like my RC Cola thing with the peanuts. It'll last. You're good for a while. Have to realize what life experience can and can't deliver. It can deliver pleasant experiences. It can deliver unpleasant experiences and neutral experiences. That's what it does. But what it also does is all of those things are pointing to open, spacious awareness. That's what it really does for us as practitioners. So to find ourselves in this form, we're now in this part of this life. It's a good thing. We have the ability. We've actually exercised that ability here. And we've got a little bit more of the night to practice, and we'll have tomorrow to practice. So we have some valuable time, invaluable time together. Yeah, these retreats aren't to be taken lightly, you know. We only get so many in our lifetime. That's the way it goes. We don't know how many we're going to get to do. So this is the big one, to really take the reverence for this. Yes, I am very fortunate. I have got to sit here. So this is a big one. Should I go a little bit more? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to segue then just into the appreciation of this life. So we have appreciated what we've got here. And then kind of in the bigger scheme of things, really appreciating this interbeing that we have. Interbeing with everything we see here, the grass, the ants, gotta give credit to the ants, the birds, the trees, the water, taking the water, got a glass of water out there, the water's in the glass, then it's in me, non-separate, we enter B, the air, you're breathing the air, I'm breathing the air, we're all breathing this, the trees are breathing out oxygen, we're breathing in the oxygen, giving them carbon dioxide. And here we are in this, floating here in space in this blue-green orb. So coming from this space of open spaciousness with the paramitas of gratitude towards the earth, everything, how generous the earth has been. So how are we doing with that? How are we doing as human beings? I think we got some work to do. So this is some good work. And then what we do with it from here, it's kind of up to us where we go. But is it important? I think so. It's all about caring. It's all about the opening of heart for this world, for our oceans, for our streams, for our mountains, for our society, for caring for others. We'll have to just see where this leads us, though, and find a way. Find your way back to open spaciousness regularly, repeatedly. Actually, that's what Avalokiteshvara said, repeatedly. So it's kind of like this whole thing with no path. Right in there he was saying, yes, but repeatedly rest in this wisdom. Rest in this wisdom is resting in this open awareness. Come back, sit. And if it takes sitting, feeling sensations of body and breath, that then point back to open awareness, by all means do that. Do it when you can, whenever you can. Okay. So let's sit for a couple minutes.